Memories of Menlo Park, Abridged from Edison, His Life and Inventions, by Frank Lewis Dyer and Thomas Comerford Martin. From the spring of 1876 to 1886, Edison lived and did his work at Menlo Park. "In 1876, I moved," says Edison, "to Menlo Park, New Jersey, on the Pennsylvania Railroad several miles from Elizabeth. The move was due to trouble I had about rent. I had rented a small shop in Newark on the top floor of a padlock factory by the month. I gave notice that I would give it up at the end of the month, paid the rent, moved out, and delivered the keys. Shortly afterward, I was served with a paper, probably a judgment, wherein I was to pay 9 months' rent. There was some law, it seems, that made a monthly renter liable for a year. This seemed so unjust that I determined to get out of a place that permitted such injustice. For several Sundays, he walked through different parts of New Jersey with two of his assistants before deciding on Menlo Park. The change was a fortunate one, for the inventor had married Miss Mary E. Stillwell and was now able to establish himself comfortably with his wife and family while enjoying immediate access to the new laboratory. Close to the Menlo Park railway station is a group of gaunt and deserted buildings. This silent group of buildings comprises the famous old laboratory and workshops of Mr. Edison, historic as being the birthplace of the carbon transmitter, the phonograph, the incandescent lamp, and the spot where Edison also worked out his system of electrical distribution, his commercial dynamo, his electric railway, his megaphone, his decimeter, and many other inventions. Here he continued, moreover, his earlier work on the quadruplex, sextuplex, multiplex, and automatic telegraphs, and did his notable pioneer work in wireless telegraphy. As the reader knows, it had been a master passion with Edison from boyhood up to possess a laboratory in which, with free use of his own time and powers, and with command of abundant material resources, he could wrestle with nature and probe her closest secrets. Thus, from the little cellar at Port Huron, from the scant shelves in a baggage car, from the nooks and corners of dingy telegraph offices, and the grimy little shops in New York and Newark, he had now come to the proud ownership of an establishment in which his favorite word, laboratory, might justly be applied. Menlo Park was the merest hamlet. Omitting the laboratory structures, it had about 7 houses, the best looking of which Edison lived in, a place that had a windmill pumping water into a reservoir. One of the stories of the day was that Edison had his front gate so connected with the pumping plant that every visitor, as he opened or closed the gate, added involuntarily to the supply in the reservoir. The main laboratory was a spacious wooden building of 2 floors. The office was in this building at first until removed to the brick library when that was finished. It was on the upper story of this laboratory that the most important experiments were executed, and where the incandescent lamp was born. This floor consisted of a large hall containing several long tables, upon which could be found all the various instruments, scientific and chemical apparatus, that the arts at the time could produce. Books lay promiscuously about, while here and there long lines of bichromate of potash cells could be seen, together with experimental models of ideas that Edison or his assistants were engaged upon. The side walls of this hall were lined with shelves filled with bottles, vials, and other receptacles containing every imaginable chemical and other material that could be obtained, while at the end of this hall and near the organ, which stood in the rear, was a large glass case containing the world's most precious metals in sheet and wire form, together with very rare and costly chemicals. When evening came on and the last rays of the setting sun penetrated through the side windows, this hall looked like a veritable Faust laboratory. On the ground floor we had our testing table, which stood on 2 large pillars of brick, built deep into the earth in order to get rid of all vibrations on account of the sensitive instruments that were upon it. There was the Thomson reflecting mirror galvanometer and electrometer, while nearby were the standard cells by which the galvanometers were adjusted and standardized. This testing table was connected by means of wires with all parts of the laboratory and machine shop, so that measurements could be conveniently made from a distance, as in those days we had no portable and direct reading instruments such as now exist. Opposite this table we installed later on our photometrical chamber, which was constructed on the Bunsen principle. A little way from this table and separated by a partition, we had the chemical laboratory with its furnaces and stink chambers. Later on, another chemical laboratory was installed near the photometer room. Next to the laboratory in importance was the machine shop, a large and well-lighted building of brick, at one end of which there was the boiler and engine room. The shop contained light and heavy lathes, boring and drilling machines, all kinds of planing machines, in fact, tools of all descriptions, so that any apparatus, however delicate or heavy, could be made and built as might be required by Edison in experimenting. Mr. John Crucy had charge of this shop and was assisted by a number of skilled mechanics. Between the machine shop and the laboratory was a small building of wood used as a carpenter shop, where Tom Logan plied his art. Nearby was the gasoline plant. Before the incandescent lamp was perfected, the only illumination was from gasoline gas, and that was used later for incandescent lamp glass blowing, which was done in another small building on one side of the laboratory. On the outskirts of the property was a small building in which lamp black was crudely but carefully manufactured and pressed into very small cakes for use in Edison carbon transmitters of the time. The night watchman, Alfred Swanson, took care of this curious plant, which consisted of a battery of petroleum lamps that were forced to burn to the sooting point. During his rounds in the night, Swanson would find time to collect from the chimneys the soot that the lamps gave. It was then weighed out into very small portions, which were pressed into cakes or buttons by means of a hand press. These little cakes were delicately packed away between layers of cotton and small light boxes, and shipped to Bergman in New York, by whom the telephone transmitters were being made. A little later, the Edison Electric Railway was built on the confines of the property out through the woods, at first only a third of a mile in length, but reaching ultimately to Pumptown, almost 3 miles away. While Edison depended upon Upton for his mathematical work, he was wont to check it up in a very practical manner, as evidenced by the following incident. Mr. Edison appeared with a glass bulb having a pear-shaped appearance in his hand. It was the kind they were going to use for our lamp experiments, and Mr. Edison asked Mr. Upton to please calculate for him its cubic contents in centimeters. Now, Mr. Upton was a very able mathematician who, after he finished his studies at Princeton, went to Germany and got his final gloss under that great master Helmholtz. Whatever he did and worked on was executed in a pure mathematical manner, and any wrangler at Oxford would have been delighted to see him juggle with integral and differential equations, with a dexterity that was surprising. He drew the shape of the bulb exactly on paper, and got the equation of its lines with which he was going to calculate its contents. When Mr. Edison again appeared and asked him what it was, he showed Edison the work he had already done on the subject, and told him he would very soon finish calculating it. "Why," said Edison, "I would simply take that bulb and fill it with mercury and weigh it, and from the weight of the mercury and its specific gravity, I'll get it in 5 minutes, and use less mental energy than is necessary in such a fatiguing operation." Menlo Park became ultimately the center of Edison's business life, as it was of his inventing. After the short distasteful period during the introduction of his lighting system, when he spent a large part of his time at the offices at 65 Fifth Avenue, New York, or on the actual work connected with the New York Edison installation, he settled back again in Menlo Park altogether. Mr. Samuel Insull describes the business methods which prevailed throughout the earlier Menlo Park days of storm and stress, and the curious conditions with which he had to deal with as a private secretary. I never attempted to systematize Edison's business life. Edison's whole method of work would upset the system of any office. He was just as likely to be at work in his laboratory at midnight as midday. He cared not for the hours of day or the days of the week. If he was exhausted, he might more likely be asleep in the middle of the day than in the middle of the night, as most of his work in the way of inventions was done at night. I used to run his office on as close business methods as my experience admitted, and I would get at him whenever it suited his convenience. Sometimes he would not go over his mail for days at a time, but other times he would go regularly to his office in the morning. At other times my engagements used to be with him to go over his business affairs at Menlo Park at night if I was occupied in New York during the day. In fact, as a matter of convenience, I used more often to get at him at night, as it left my days free to transact his affairs, and enabled me, probably at a midnight luncheon, to get a few minutes of his time to look over his correspondence and get his directions as to what I should do in some particular negotiation or matter of finance. While it was a matter of suiting Edison's convenience as to when I should transact business with him, it also suited my own idea, as it enabled me, after getting through my business with him, to enjoy the privilege of watching him at his work and to learn something about the technical side of matters. Whatever knowledge I may have of the electric light and power industry, I feel I owe it to the tuition of Edison. He was about the most willing tutor, and I must confess that he had to be a patient one. Many a time during the long, weary nights of experimenting, Edison would call a halt for refreshments, which he had ordered always to be sent in when the night work was in progress. Everything would be dropped, all present would join in the meal, and the last good story or joke would pass around. In his notes, Mr. Gell says, "Our lunch always ended with a cigar, and I may mention here that although Edison was never fastidious in eating, he always relished a good cigar, and seemed to find in it consolation and solace. It often happened that while we were enjoying the cigars after our midnight repast, one of the boys would start up a tune on the organ and we would all sing together, or one of the others would give a solo. Another of the boys had a voice that sounded like something between the ring of an old tomato can and a pewter jug. He had one song that he would sing while we roared with laughter. He was also great in imitating the tinfoil phonograph. On many of these occasions, the laboratory was the residence of jolly and convivial visitors, mostly old friends and acquaintances of Mr. Edison. Some of the office employees would also drop in once in a while, and as everybody present was always welcome to partake of the midnight meal, we all enjoyed these gatherings. After a while, when we were ready to resume work, our visitors would intimate that they were going home to bed, but we fellows could stay up and work, and they would depart generally singing some songs like "Good Night, Ladies." It often happened that when Edison had been working up to 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, he would lie down on one of the laboratory tables and with nothing but a couple of books for a pillow, would fall into a sound sleep. He said it did him more good than being in a soft bed, which spoils a man. Some of the laboratory assistants could be seen now and then sleeping on a table in the early morning hours. The irrepressible spirit of humor in the old days, although somewhat strenuous at times, caused many a moment of hilarity, which seemed to refresh the boys and enabled them to work with renewed vigor after its manifestation. Mr. Upton remarked that often during the period of the invention of the incandescent lamp, when under great strain and fatigue, Edison would go to the organ and play tunes in a primitive way, and come back to crack jokes with the staff. but I have often felt that Mr. Edison could never comprehend the limitations of the strength of other men, as his own physical and mental strength have always seemed to be without limit. He could work continuously as long as he wished and had sleep at his command. His sleep was always instant, profound, and restful. He told me that he never dreamed. I've known Edison now for 31 years and feel that he's always kept his mind direct and simple, going straight to the root of troubles. One of the peculiarities I've noticed is that I have never known him to break into a conversation going on around him and ask what people were talking about. The nearest he would ever come to it was when there had evidently been some story told, and his face would express a desire to join in the laugh, which would immediately invite telling the story to him. Next to those who worked with Edison at the laboratory and were with him constantly in Menlo Park were the visitors, some of whom were business associates, some of them scientific men, and some of them hero worshippers and curiosity hunters. Foremost in the first category was Mr. E. H. Johnson, who was in reality Edison's most intimate friend, and was required for constant consultation, but whose intense activity, remarkable grasp of electrical principles, and unusual powers of exposition led to his frequent detachment for long trips, including those which resulted in the introduction of the telephone, phonograph, and electric light in England and on the continent. A less frequent visitor was Mr. S. Bergman, who had all he needed to occupy his time in experimenting and manufacturing, and whose contemporaneous Worcester Street letterheads advertised Edison's inventions as being made there. One notable afternoon at Menlo Park was that on which the New York Board of Aldermen had a special train out to Menlo Park to see the lighting system with its conductors underground in operation. The Edison Electric Illuminating Company was applying for a franchise, and the aldermen, for lack of scientific training and special practical information, were very skeptical on the subject, as indeed they might well be. Mr. Edison demonstrated personally the details and merits of the system to them. The voltage was increased to a higher pressure than usual, and all the incandescent lamps in Menlo Park did their best to win the approbation of the New York City fathers. After Edison had finished exhibiting all the good points of his system, he conducted his guests upstairs in the laboratory, where a long table was spread with the best things that one of the most prominent New York caterers could furnish. The laboratory witnessed high times that night, for all were in the best of humor, and many a bottle was drained in toasting the health of Edison and the aldermen. This was one of the extremely rare occasions on which Edison had addressed an audience, but the stake was worth the effort. The representatives of New York could with justice drink the health of the young inventor, whose system is one of the greatest boons a city has ever had conferred upon it. Another frequent visitor was Mr. Edison's father, who would sometimes come into the laboratory with his two grandchildren, a little boy and girl called Dash and Dot. He preferred to sit and watch his brilliant son at work, with an expression of satisfaction on his face that indicated a sense of happiness and content that his boy, born in that distant, humble home in Ohio, had risen to fame and brought such honor upon the name. It was indeed a pathetic sight to see a father venerate his son as the elder Edison did. Not less at home was Mr. McKenzie, the Mount Clemens station agent, the life of whose child Edison had saved when a train newsboy. The old Scotchman was one of the innocent chartered libertines of the place, with an unlimited stock of good jokes and stories, but seldom of any practical use. On one occasion, however, when everything possible and impossible under the sun was being carbonized for lamp filaments, he allowed a handful of his bushy red beard to be taken for the purpose, and his laugh was the loudest when the Edison McKenzie hair lamps were brought up to incandescence, their richness in red rays being slyly attributed to the nature of the filamentary material. Oddly enough, a few years later, some inventors actually took out a patent for making incandescent lamps with carbonized hair for filaments. Returning to the work itself, note of which has already been made in this and preceding chapters, we find an interesting and unique reminiscence in Mr. Gell's notes of the reversion to carbon as a filament in the lamps, following an exhibition of metallic filament lamps given in the spring of 1879 to the men in the syndicate advancing the funds for these experiments. They came to Menlo Park on a late afternoon train from New York. It was already dark when they were conducted into the machine shop, where we had several platinum lamps installed in series. When Edison had finished explaining the principles and details of the lamp, he asked Krusey to let the dynamo machine run. It was one of the gamma type, as our first dynamo of the Edison design was not yet finished. Edison then ordered the juice to be turned on slowly. Today I can see those lamps rising to a cherry red like glow bugs, and hear Mr. Edison saying, "A little more juice," and the lamps began to glow. "A little more" is the command again, and then one of the lamps emits for an instant a light like a star in the distance, after which there is an eruption and a puff, and the machine shop is in total darkness. We knew instantly which lamp had failed, and Batchelor replaced that by a good one, having a few reserves nearby. The operation was repeated two or three times with about the same results, after which the party went into the library until it was time to catch the train for New York. Such an exhibition was decidedly discouraging, and it was not a jubilant party that returned to New York. But that night Edison remained in the laboratory meditating upon the results that the platinum lamp had given so far. I was engaged reading a book near a table in the front, while Edison was seated in a chair by a table near the organ. With his head turned downward, and that conspicuous lock of hair hanging loosely on one side, he looked like Napoleon in the celebrated picture, on the eve of the great battle. Those days were heroic ones, for then he battled against mighty odds, and the prospects were dim and not very encouraging. In case of emergency, Edison always possessed a keen faculty of deciding immediately and correctly what to do, and the decision he then arrived at was predestined to be the turning point that led him on to ultimate success. After that exhibition, we had a house cleaning in the laboratory, and the metallic filament lamps were stored away, while the preparations were made for our experiments on carbon lamps. Thus the work went on. Menlo Park has hitherto been associated in the public thought with the telephone, phonograph, and incandescent lamp. But it was there equally that the Edison dynamo and system of distribution were created and applied to their specific purposes. While all the study of a possible lamp was going on, Mr. Upton was busy calculating the economy of the multiple arc system and making a great many tables to determine what resistance a lamp should have for the best results, and at what point the proposed general system would fall off in economy when the lamps were of the lower resistance that was generally assumed to be necessary. The world at that time had not the shadow of an idea as to what the principles of a multiple arc system should be, enabling millions of lamps to be lighted off distributing circuits, each lamp independent of the other. But at Menlo Park at that remote period in the 70s, Mr. Edison's mathematician was formulating the inventor's conception in clear, instructive figures, and the work then executed has held its own ever since. From the beginning of his experiments on electric light, Mr. Edison had a well-defined idea of producing not only a practical lamp, but also a system of commercial electric lighting. Such a scheme involved the creation of an entirely new art, for there was nothing on the face of the earth from which to draw assistance or precedent, unless we accept the elementary forms of dynamos then in existence. It is true there were several types of machines in use for the then very limited field of arc lighting, but they were regarded as valueless as part of a great comprehensive scheme which could supply everybody with light. Edison declared he did not intend to build up a system of distribution in which the external resistance would be equal to the internal resistance. He said he was just about going to do the opposite. He wanted a large external resistance and a low internal one. He said he wanted to sell the energy outside of the station and not waste it in the dynamo and conductors where it brought no profits. In these later days, when these ideas of Edison are used as common property and are applied in every modern system of distribution, it is astonishing to remember that when they were propounded, they met with the most vehement antagonism from the world at large. Edison, familiar with batteries and telegraphy, could not bring himself to believe that any substitute generator of electrical energy could be efficient that used up half its own possible output before doing an equal amount of outside work. Undaunted by the dicta of contemporaneous science, Mr. Edison attacked the dynamo problem with his accustomed vigor and thoroughness. He chose the drum form for his armature and experimented with different kinds of iron. Cores were made of cast iron, others of forged iron, and still others of sheets of iron of various thicknesses separated from each other by paper or paint. These cores were then allowed to run in an excited field, and after a given time their temperatures were measured and noted. By such practical methods, Edison found that the thin laminated cores of sheet iron gave the least heat and had the least amount of wasteful eddy currents. His experiments and ideas on magnetism at that period were far in advance of the time. After thorough investigation of the magnetic qualities of different kinds of iron, Edison began to make a study of winding the cores, first determining the electromotive force generated per turn of wire at various speeds in the fields of different intensities. He also considered various forms and shapes for the armature, and by methodical and systematic research, he obtained the data and best conditions upon which he could build his generator. In the field magnets of his dynamo, he constructed the cores and yoke of forged iron, having a very large cross-section, which was a new thing in those days. Great attention was also paid to all the joints, which were smoothed down so as to make a perfect magnetic contact. The Edison dynamo, with its large masses of iron, was a vivid contrast to the then-existing types, with their meager quantities of the ferric element. Edison also made tests on his field magnets by slowly raising the strength of the exciting current so that he obtained figures similar to those shown by a magnetic curve, and in this way found where saturation commenced and where it was useless to expend more current on the field. The laboratory notebooks of the period bear abundant evidence of the systematic and searching nature of these experiments and investigations in the hundreds of pages of notes, sketches, and calculations and tables made at the time by Edison, Upton, Batchelor, Gell, and by others who from time to time were entrusted with special experiments to elucidate some particular point. Mr. Gell says, "The experiments on the armature winding were also very interesting. Edison had a number of small wooden cores made at both ends of which we inserted little brass nails, and we wound the wooden cores with twine as if it were wire on an armature. In this way we studied armature winding, and had matches where each of us had a core, while bets were made as to whose would be the first to furnish properly and correctly a certain kind of winding. Care had to be taken that the wound core corresponded to the direction of the current, supposing it were placed in a field and revolved." After Edison had decided this question, Upton made drawings and tables from which the real armatures were wound and connected to the commutator. To a student of today, all this seems simple. But in those days, the art of constructing dynamos was about as dark as air navigation is at present. Edison also improved the armature by dividing it and the commutator into a far greater number of sections than up to that time had been the practice. He was also the first to use mica in insulating the commutator sections from each other. In the meantime, during the progress of the investigations on the dynamo, word had gone out to the world that Edison expected to invent a generator of greater efficiency than any that existed at the time. Again he was assailed and ridiculed by the technical press, for had not the foremost electricians and physicists of Europe and America worked for years on the production of dynamos and arc lamps as they then existed? Even though this young man at Menlo Park had done some wonderful things for telegraphy and telephony, even if he had recorded and reproduced human speech, he had his limitations, and could not upset the settled dictum of science that the internal resistance must equal the external resistance. Such was the trend of public opinion at the time. But after Mr. Krusey had finished the first practical dynamo, and after Mr. Upton had tested it thoroughly and verified his figures and results several times, for he also was surprised, Edison was able to tell the world that he had made a generator giving an efficiency of 90%. 90% as against 40% was a mighty hit. The world would not believe it. Criticism and argument were again at their height, while Upton, as Edison's duelist, was kept busy replying to private and public challenges of the fact. The tremendous progress of the world in the last quarter of a century, owing to the revolution caused by the all-conquering march of heavy current engineering, is the outcome of Edison's work at Menlo Park that raised the efficiency of the dynamo from 40% to 90%. Mr. Upton sums it up very precisely in his remarks upon this period. What has now been made clear by accurate nomenclature was then very foggy in the textbooks. Mr. Edison had completely grasped the effect of subdivision of circuits and the influence of wires leading to such subdivisions when it was most difficult to express what he knew in technical language. I remember distinctly when Mr. Edison gave me the problem of placing a motor in circuit in multiple arc with a fixed resistance, and I had to work out the problem entirely, as I could find no prior solution. There was nothing I could find bearing upon the counter-electromotive force of the armature and the effect of the resistance of the armature on the work given out by the armature. It was a wonderful experience to have problems given me out of the intuition of a great mind, based on enormous experience in practical work and applying to new lines of progress. One of the main impressions left upon me after knowing Mr. Edison for many years is the marvelous accuracy of his guesses. He will see the general nature of a result long before it can be reached by mathematical calculation. His greatness was always to be clearly seen when difficulties arose. They always made him cheerful and started him thinking, and very soon would come a line of suggestions which would not end until the difficulty was met and overcome, or found insurmountable. I have often felt that Mr. Edison got himself purposely into trouble by premature publications and otherwise, so that he would have an incentive to get himself out of the trouble. This chapter may well end with a statement from Mr. Gell, shrewd and observant, as a participant in all the early work of the development of the Edison lighting system. Those who were gathered around him in the old Menlo Park laboratory enjoyed his confidence, and he theirs. Nor was the confidence ever abused. He was respected with a respect which only great men can obtain, and he never showed by any word or act that he was their employer in a sense that would hurt the feelings, as is often the case in the ordinary course of business life. He conversed, argued, and disputed with us all as if he were a colleague on the same footing. It was his winning ways and manners that attached us all so loyally to his side and made us ever ready with a boundless devotion to execute any request or desire.